Coming up on this week's book show, Flynn Berry, the Edgar Award-winning author of Under the Harrow, has established herself as one of the best new voices in suspense. Her latest, Northern Spy, is a thriller about the contemporary IRA and two sisters who find themselves caught in the middle of the re-escalating sectarian conflict in Northern Ireland. Flynn Berry, on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Flynn Berry, the Edgar Award-winning author of Under the Harrow and A Double Life, has established herself as one of the best new voices in suspense. She returns now with Northern Spy, a well-researched and crafted thriller about the contemporary IRA and two sisters who find themselves caught in the middle of the re-escalating sectarian conflict in Northern Ireland. Berry's thriller is an exploration of sisterhood and motherhood and an exploration of life in the midst of an entrenched conflict and its often unseen repercussions. It is a great pleasure to welcome Flynn Berry to this week's book show. Flynn, thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Given that you have written in the past about England and now you are writing about Ireland in such an immersive way, what drew you to Ireland and Northern Ireland in particular?
So my family is mostly from Ireland and I've always just been pretty obsessed with it. I feel like it's just kind of in my blood. And the first time I visited Ireland, I remember feeling like I had just come home. And I have always been especially interested in the conflict in the North because it's such a strange scenario to have essentially a war going on the home front where you have people living in such close proximity who have reason to be suspicious of each other or to fear one another. And so that seemed like really ripe territory for fiction.
Of course, there are enormous differences. I mean, Ireland and Northern Ireland that you look at. Did you want to explore both? And was there a conscious decision? Because most of this novel takes place in Belfast and regions around it. So was the sole focus then?
It was. Yeah, I really fell in love with the North and with Belfast in particular. And I wanted to get at what it's like to be living in a society that's ostensibly at peace and has been since the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, but where there's still quite a lot of tension lurking under the surface. And a lot of the issues from the conflict haven't been resolved, and there hasn't been a big peace and reconciliation movement after the conflict. And so it seemed like kind of a tinderbox. And I wanted to explore what that would be like for someone like my narrator, who's just trying to live her life and work and raise her family in the midst of what seems to be a situation that could explode at any moment.
I actually had to look the town up of where these characters live for the most part. And it is east of Belfast with water in between. So describe the geography of where you placed your narrator and her sister.
Tessa lives between Strangford Loch, which is a huge seawater lake, and the ocean. And it's this really gorgeous strip of land that's farms and meadows and really lush green trees that's between this big body of water with one of the fastest tides in the world and the sea. And I think people maybe don't know how completely gorgeous Northern Ireland is. It's definitely less touristed than the Republic of Ireland. And I saw the name Gray Abbey, which is the town where Tessa lives, at a bus station in Belfast and really loved the name and decided to go look around and moved her home there because the village itself was just so appealing. And it's really one of the most beautiful places I've ever visited.
What's fascinating about that locale is that it is close to the city, and yet it's also in the middle of nowhere.
It is. And that seemed really central to the whole kind of heart of the book, which is what is it like to live somewhere that looks and seems safe? Tessa lives in a small town and it's idyllic, but at any moment the violence could erupt there. And that's sort of the defining trait of the Troubles, that you had all these places that people felt were places of safety, like a restaurant or a bar or a field or the beach, and even a funeral was attacked at one point, and they all became proven to be places where actually you were still under a degree of threat.
What is it like for you to get the language, to understand and to nail the language and to make it feel as though those characters are indeed living in Northern Ireland as they do?
Yeah, I was really nervous about writing this book in particular because of that reason. There's kind of a joke in Northern Ireland that actors can never get their accent right. That, you have Brad Pitt played an IRA man in a movie and had a vo voice coach for it. And they just sort of tease Americans who try to speak as though they're from there. And I was worried about that in writing as well. And so the way I kind of worked around it was to do just huge amounts of research and to listen to as much as I could. So I listened to every single archived episode of this BBC comedy panel show that's recorded in Northern Ireland to try to get the sort of like pacing of the speech and also the phrases that people say. Like there's an expression, catch yourself on, which means kind of like don't be ridiculous,
Right.
or if you lose the run of yourself, you've kind of lost control. And I just tried to sort of make sure that I was getting all of those right without, veering into caricature or anything.
In your earlier novels, and when you're writing about England, I assume you went through a similar practice.
I did, yeah. I had a A to Z map book of London on my desk while I was working on my last book, and would just kind of flip through it and read the street names and try to make sure that I was in the world as much as I could be. And I think that's also just the joy of writing for me, is getting to lead a kind of parallel life for as long as I'm working on the book. So I have this whole kind of other pool that I'm learning about and exploring in addition to my own daily life.
So, as you decide that you want to write a book about Ireland, why then did you hone in on Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I've always been interested in the Troubles in particular because you have this really pretty small and close-knit community in Northern Ireland where you have neighbors living aside one another who might be involved in paramilitary activity and who are leading these kind of double lives. And so there's a fair amount of maybe suspicion or fear under the surface of this really beautiful kind of idyllic landscape. And so I wanted to write about that atmosphere and also about what it's like to be just an ordinary person living somewhere that has a heightened threat level, and how you sort of go about your own daily routine with bomb threats or attacks happening in the background.
So the person we meet in the novel is Tessa, who is born and raised in Belfast. She is a news producer for the BBC, a single mom, and is raising a 6-month-old son, which of course brings its own shares of dilemmas. And while the IRA is reemerging, as you say, she's just a normal person going about her life and then is thrown into this. Talk a little bit about the setup of the novel.
Yeah, so Tessa is a producer at the BBC. She has a 6-month-old baby, and she's trying to sort of find her feet as a working mother after her maternity leave. And she's at work one day when she sees news footage from a surveillance camera of an IRA robbery at a gas station. And in the footage, she sees her beloved younger sister, Marion, pulling a ski mask down over her face. And the police think that Marion is a member of the IRA. And Tessa thinks that she has been coerced into working for them. And the book begins with her kind of investigation into what has happened to her sister and where her sister is, and sort of spirals from there.
One of the things that I found so fascinating about the novel is the contemporary nature of the Troubles. The idea that even with a Good Friday Agreement, that there very much is great turmoil in Northern Ireland. What led you to that, and talk about the research that you went through to put this in a contemporary context?
So the book is set in sort of a contemporary or maybe a couple of years in the future setting. And I did that because it felt like the Troubles aren't over. They've kind of gone underground in that the tensions and the kind of suspicion has, for the most part, been under the surface. But the central dilemma of the Troubles, which is should the island of Ireland be united or should it remain in the north part of the United Kingdom, that issue hasn't gone away. There's still a border on the island of Ireland, and there are still some people who would risk anything to remove that border, and some people who would risk anything to stay part of the United Kingdom with that border. Just this past week, there has been incredible, really intense rioting in Belfast. And you've had kids as young as 12 and 13 throwing rocks and petrol bombs at police vehicles. A bus was hijacked and set on fire. And there have been politicians across the world. The White House and the Irish leader have been sort of calling for calm and for peace and order. And it's just sort of showing that for this new generation of kids coming up who are maybe being encouraged by older former paramilitary leaders, they maybe haven't seen the benefits of peace that they were promised. They haven't been given the sort of better society that was hoped for with the Good Friday Agreement. And so there's kind of a tinderbox atmosphere at the moment. The vast majority of people just want to live peacefully and get to work and raise their children and have their children go to school in peace. But you still have sort of radical groups on the sidelines who are very dangerous.
Flynn Berry is our guest. The new novel is Northern Spy. It is published by Viking. Prior to COVID, I spent some time in Belfast and in Northern Ireland. And what amazed me, and I don't know if you had a similar reaction, what amazed me was that I had this silly notion as an Irish American that while there was still a lot of angst, that there wasn't the violence that the peace accord had essentially worked until you visit and realize that there's still the razor wire and there's still the graffiti and there's still killings on the streets. And that shook me up. I was really surprised by that. And I think it's something that many people don't know, that it still very much is a part of everyday life in Belfast and throughout Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and I think the big kind of issue is that the society is still pretty divided between Protestants and Catholics, in that you have most children going to school with members of their own religion, and most towns you sort of know if you're in a Protestant town or a Catholic town. And when I was over there, someone would point out and say, like, "Oh, that's the Protestant cake shop." Or, that's the Catholic one. And they just know. I talked to the writer Adrian McGinty, who has a really wonderful sort of noir series set in Belfast and grew up there. And he said it's like he was born with this superpower he doesn't want, which is the ability to figure out within a couple minutes of talking to someone if they're Catholic or Protestant. It's still a pretty divided society in some ways, even as it is also this Belfast is a wonderful, bustling, vibrant, modern city with all this tourism and these great movies and TV shows being filmed around it. It does still have, like you said, that razor wire. There are peace walls between communities and those murals of gunmen on the sides of buildings. So it's a very uneasy peace, it feels like.
The moment where Tessa realizes that it's her sister on that television screen, what is so alarming to her as it is to the reader who finds out that the night before, this is a woman, Marion, who is with Tessa's son and who is being an aunt. And to have that, even the idea of that double life is really disturbing.
It's also often the case that in a family, one person might become radicalized and the rest not. And so I'm interested also in what happens to people who are kind of left behind if someone joins a group like this. And like you said, if it's someone who's your beloved sister and takes care of your baby, how do you sort of find that person again, or how do you understand them? Is a really interesting question. When I was over there, I heard about two sisters who grew up in Northern Ireland, and one of them left and went away to university, and the other stayed and joined the IRA. While one of them was studying in a library, the other was lying in a ditch performing surveillance on a police station. And I thought it was just really interesting to think that you could have two women from the same family with the same upbringing take such radically different paths in their lives.
Allows you then in the story to explore sisterhood and all its beauty and strangeness, right? I mean that there can be a lot of complexity there.
And they do still have a pretty normal, I think, sibling relationship in that there are rivalries. Tessa's sort of irritated because Marion is always her mother's favorite and can sort of do no wrong in her mother's eyes. And they can argue and disagree and bicker, and they would also do anything to protect the other, which is something that my mom is one of four sisters, and I've seen that dynamic in her family where they can just drive each other to distraction and press each other's buttons, but then they also have this deep, deep love, and they share the same memories. They can remind each other of things that happened when they were 5 years old, and that's such a different relationship than any other we have in our lives where they're sort of bounded by smaller time frames.
Tessa's mother is indeed helping Tessa in the raising of her child while she goes to work and so forth, although she has her own work that she's doing as a housekeeper. And yet, as you noted, there is this strain a little bit of sibling rivalry, but it also, to me, in reading, showed how strong the mother daughter bond is that no matter what this child is accused of, the mother is going to defend her.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think it's just one of those truths that you can't fall out of love with your child, really, right? Like there's nothing that you could learn
Right.
that would make you turn against your child, I think, for the most part. And it was interesting to write that older version of motherhood alongside Tessa's own motherhood, where she has her new baby who's only 6 months old. So just looking at how complicated that relationship can get to in later adulthood.
As Tessa is telling us the story, she is writing a lot and telling us a lot about Finn. And there's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of emotion that comes out, a lot of concern, even in the quickest of experiences of what he will remember of them and her concern as to what actually permeates.
For me, and for a lot of mothers I know who work as well, the guilt is just pretty unavoidable. Like, I feel like at any given point, there should be two versions of me, and one can work and the other can just spend the whole day with my boys. Tessa is sort of trying to deal with quite a lot at once, where she's trying to raise her son and work as a single mother. And then she's also dealing with this kind of huge threat of being embroiled with the IRA and trying to protect her son at all costs.
Flynn Berry is our guest. Again, the name of the book is Northern Spy. You mentioned the research that you did in Northern Ireland and Belfast in particular. So give us an idea of what that was like, how long you spent, and what ultimately you were trying to get to the bottom of.
I stayed in a house in Belfast that became Marion's home in the book, this terraced brick house off the Lisburn Road. And I sort of pretended to be Tessa a bit. So I went, she works at the BBC. So I went to the BBC and shadowed a producer and sat in on live recordings of interviews and radio shows and, ate lunch in the staff canteen and made tea in the staff kitchen and toured the whole building and saw, the TV studio and the makeup room and the whole kind of structure of the office. And then I also spent time in the village where she lives with her son, which is called Grey Abbey. So I spent time there, and then I also did a lot of interviews. So I interviewed security journalists and a detective who worked in counterterrorism, and former IRA members and journalists, and just tried to sort of get as much information as I could, kind of operating on the iceberg principle that there would be, some of the research would be above the surface in the writing itself, but that I needed to have a huge mass of research under the surface in order to be able to tell the story properly.
What were you most concerned about in telling the story properly? Was it the politics? Was it the troubles themselves? The deep-rooted sense of that morass, if you will?
I think so, because I think I was really wary of romanticizing it from any angle. I think Irish Americans can be pretty romantic about the IRA. During the Troubles, Irish Americans donated huge amounts of money to the IRA for them to buy weapons. And it's easy to do that from the outside, where we're not in any sort of danger from them, and we don't need to worry about our bus being hijacked or bomb going off in a shopping center where we're shopping. And so I wanted to be sure that I wasn't romanticizing the conflict from any angle and that I wasn't being sentimental about the IRA or about MI5 and its handlers who work in Northern Ireland, and that I was kind of looking at the conflict with a clear lens and that I was looking at it as it would have felt if you were living through it on the ground. And I also wanted to be sure that I was getting the voice right and the dialogue right and making sure that it sounded the way it would if you had stepped into a home in Belfast and you were listening in on a conversation between a mother and her daughter, that would feel right.
And it certainly does feel that way. What was the editing process like to refine that to a point where it sounded right to you?
Yeah, so I work just like wildly inefficiently because I write a really long first draft longhand and then I type it all up and then I usually decide that it's not at all what the story should be and start over from scratch. And so there's just quite a lot of drafting and redrafting and reworking every page. And then once I got to a point where I felt like I had sort of moved it along enough, I sent it to a producer at the BBC and she read the whole draft and sort of gave me comments on if anything I'd said was inaccurate about how a producer works at the BBC, for example, or if you would say frosting or icing for a cake, that kind of thing. And that felt really fun to be having sort of my character almost, because she works at the same job,
Right.
reading through the book and giving me notes.
It's interesting because the BBC comes even into question in the book too about where their loyalties lie, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, I interviewed a reporter named Mark Davenport, who's kind of a legend in Northern Ireland for, since he's been a political reporter since the Troubles. He was saying that in the beginning he encountered some suspicion or resistance because the BBC is, based in London and it's a British, or it has been based in London and it's a British company, and so there's an idea that maybe they're biased one way or the other. But what Mark said and what I heard a lot at the BBC was that basically, they get complaints from both sides of the political divide, and that makes them think they're doing their job right. If everyone has a reason to complain, then they think they're telling things as impartially as possible.
Some of the commonalities that I was in reading the novel as I was watching all this unfold over the past several days and weeks of what we've seen in the streets in Northern Ireland is that they're often going after the police are a target of the violence and the anger and politicians, which is what we read about in the book too.
One of my interview sources was a senior detective in counterterrorism, and he said that He carries a personal protection weapon on him. He's meant to check under his car for a device when he leaves the house in the morning. And he has given press conferences talking about his, unit's work. And he said that it's kind of a bad idea to be the face of counterterrorism because it makes him even more of a target. Just this past week in the rioting, over 70 police officers have been injured because the rioters have been throwing rocks and petrol bombs at them. So it is a hugely dangerous job. It's particularly dangerous during the Troubles for Catholics. If Catholics joined the police force, then they were considered sort of traitors and they would be especially made into targets.
There are times where characters in this book are getting out and checking under their cars for bombs, and to think that that's a normal way of life for anyone is really interesting.
Yeah, the writer Adrian McGinty, who's written a series of detective novels outside Belfast and who grew up in Carrickfergus outside Belfast, so that he was driven to school every day by someone who I think he was in the army, not the police, but that when he was driven to school, the man would check under the car every time before the boys got in. And that one day they were driving and Adrian realized that he hadn't checked under the car that morning. And he spent the ride terrified, thinking that he was possibly about to die. And that moment then recurs, and he writes about that moment in one of his books. And it does seem like it's just this really odd fear that you think probably things are fine, but there's a chance that you're a target and you don't really know, even if you're somewhere that seems ostensibly to be completely peaceful and safe, like a restaurant or a sort of quiet village, like the one where Tessa lives.
So, as you have now written this novel, have you decided if you would return to Ireland or where you go to geographically next?
So the new book is set in New England, but it features an Irish protagonist, which is sort of my way of cheating. I'm not ready to leave Ireland or Northern Ireland behind. I could have kept researching this book for the rest of my life. It just was completely engrossing and fascinating to research. And I am still also really kind of tied to the stories of the women who I met when I was researching it, and they're still very alive in my mind as well.
Is it also contemporary?
It is contemporary, yes.
Do you like that of writing of what, as you said, you can of this novel, that it can take place now or perhaps a few years from now, that is, you're comfortable with that time frame?
I am, I have an idea for a historical fiction book that I want someone else to write, which is about this woman named Grania, which is anglicized as Grace, who was the pirate queen of Ireland. At one point, she ruled, I think it was dozens of ships and hundreds of men were at her disposal. And she was active at the same time as Queen Elizabeth in England. And they actually had a sort of summit meeting. And I think that's such a great topic for a book, but I can't do historical fiction. I really like writing about our present moment and the texture of our present moment, but I hope someone else will write it.
Well, in the meantime, we have this beautiful novel to read and enjoy. It is Northern Spy. It is published by Viking. Flynn Berry, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Joe. So nice talking with you.
Great pleasure. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, or you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.